Hi, Laura Murphy Oates here. It's been a while since I've said the name Donald Trump. He's not on Twitter, he's not on Facebook, and like many people, I've been wondering if he's decided to step back from political life altogether. Today, we're playing you an episode from our global news podcast, Today in Focus, where we learn that's not the case. Guardian reporter David Smith looks at two states in the US and the ways that Donald Trump continues to exert his influence. I'll let Rachel Humphreys, a producer and presenter on Today in Focus, take it over from here.
Wow, thank you.
It may feel that we now live in a world without Donald Trump, but in many red states across the US, he's still campaigning like it's 2020.
I told you, crime is surging, murders are soaring, police departments are being gutted, illegal aliens are overrunning their borders. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. Our poor borders, they were so perfect, they were so good.
Guardian Washington Bureau Chief David Smith recently went along to one of his rallies in Ohio and found the former president to be as bullish as ever.
It was like stepping through the looking glass into an upside-down world where left is right and up is down and everything you think about the world is turned on its head in the view of his real hardcore supporters. One woman wore a T-shirt that said, "Unmasked, unmuzzled, unvaccinated, unafraid." And someone else wore a T-shirt that said, "If you don't like Trump, then you probably don't like me, and I'm okay with that." They say there's a joy in being together with other people who are angry. And as of old, Trump will describe the media as fake news, and the crowd all turns and jeers and boos.
"Together, we will send Joe Biden and the fake news media." There's a lot of people back there. Look at that. Look at that. Look at that.
If you purely stayed in Manhattan, New York, or central Washington, D.C., it would be easy to believe Trump is a former president. He's off the agenda. He's certainly off Twitter and Facebook. Perhaps things are getting back to normal. We can go back to autopilot and American democracy has been saved. But when you get to smaller towns around America and go to a Trump rally and see still the force of enthusiasm for him among this base, it's a reminder that the personality cult is alive and well.
Even though Trump isn't president anymore, his power hasn't gone away. Across the US, away from Washington, his Republican followers hold office and are finding ways to keep a radical conservative agenda alive.
Trump and the people that support him are the Republican Party now. I think Donald Trump has a pretty good chance of being back in the White House within the year.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the Republican backlash against Joe Biden's vision for America. David, you've told us about going to those Trump rallies, and there was maybe an expectation after the last election that there would be a return to normal in Washington after he lost. What has the prevailing mood been amongst Republicans in reality?
Generally one of defiance. They're relatively united in opposition to Joe Biden and his agenda, as you would expect them to be against a Democrat and as they certainly were against Barack Obama before Trump took office. I think some Republicans at least had a real jolt on the 6th of January when an armed mob of Trump supporters stormed the US Capitol. And that night, some of them wavered.
"We condemn the violence that took place here in the strongest possible terms."
"Count me out. Enough is enough. Baby, I, above all others in this body, need to say this. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are lawfully elected.
The United States Senate will not be intimidated."
But even so, more than 140 of them voted to overturn the election result in vain. And then very quickly, you saw the party backslide towards total loyalty to Trump. Some would say his grip on the party is now tighter than ever.
Can you remind us what the national electoral map looked like after November's election?
Well, at first glance, Democrats did tremendously well in the 2020 elections because they won the White House. Joe Biden, with a margin of 7 million national popular votes over Donald Trump. They also retained the House of Representatives and eventually narrowly won the Senate.
And what about at a state level?
You know, Democrats did tremendously well in 2018, but then underperformed in 2020. Republicans have the majority in 30 state legislatures. And also, there are 23 states where they have that majority. Plus, there's also a Republican governor. So that gives them quite a lot of power and autonomy, irrespective of what's going on in Washington.
What kind of challenges have state governments posed to the federal government in recent years?
What's been interesting is during the Trump years, some of the most significant resistance to Donald Trump came from state governments, in particular New York and California, both obviously huge economies, both very liberal, very diverse, under Democratic control. They took the Trump administration to court numerous times, and they were able to sometimes find workarounds when the federal government wanted to do something on immigration or whatever it was. Now, obviously, the boot is on the other foot. The tables are turned. We have a Democratic administration in Washington. And you're seeing states such as Florida and Texas, both under Republican control, really becoming the bulwark of the pro-Trump resistance.
Let's focus on one of those examples, Texas, to get a sense of the forces in play across red states. When the votes were being counted there back in November, it looked like it was going to be very close between Republicans and Democrats, wasn't it?
Texas is an interesting microcosm of trends happening in America as a whole, in particular, diversification and the decline of white male Christian America. And the theory has always been that this will help Democrats because people of color and other minority groups for the last half century or so have tended to vote Democratic. And there was a theory in 2020, maybe the moment would come with the backlash against Donald Trump and cities in Texas, such as Austin, which are now very liberal leaning and diverse and young and really embracing the Democratic Party. I think a former Texas governor, Rick Perry, has said these are like blueberries in a tomato soup, these little dots of blue in the sea of Republican red. But when it came to it in the 2020 election, Donald Trump gained 5.9 million votes there. Joe Biden got 5.3 million votes. That was incredibly disappointing for Democrats, hoping for a miracle, but they are eating away at Republicans' advantage. And that might explain why Republicans are veering to the right and really digging in and trying to shore up their power there.
And tell us about Greg Abbott, the Texas governor. Who is he? What's he like?
So Greg Abbott is the Republican governor of Texas. He was elected in 2014.
Look what you see. You see an unfinished border. This is Biden's fault because President Biden is not continuing what President Trump began.
The first Texas governor actually to have a disability. He uses a wheelchair. That was because when he was 26 years old, he was paralyzed below the waist when an oak tree fell on him while he was jogging after a storm. And he's very much emerging as a hero of the Trump Making America Great Again movement, increasingly right-wing, increasingly seen as defying the Joe Biden administration.
How is he doing that? You know, what sort of policies are Republicans in Texas pushing through?
Republicans in Texas are really veering far to the right.
Of the bills he signed, one included the controversial permitless carry bill, which allows Texans who are 21 years and older to carry a firearm without a license or training. Opponents of the bill were against it, as they said it would remove barriers aimed at keeping people who are not legally fit to possess a gun from carrying one. Despite that, it was passed, and Governor Abbott today said these bills now make Texas a Second Amendment sanctuary state.
They had a flurry just in May where Abbott and Republicans there passed legislation banning abortion when a fetal heartbeat can be detected after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. That's often before women even know they are pregnant.
The Texas heartbeat bill is now law in the Lone Star State.
The bill does not make exceptions for survivors of rape or incest who become pregnant from the crime, only for medical emergencies. The bill also allows Texans to sue a doctor who performs or has an intent to perform an abortion.
Abbott has also tried to strike a populist chord by moving to stop transgender athletes competing in school sports. And there's a significant crackdown on voting rights in Texas. Restrictions they're imposing on mail-in ballots, on voter ID, blocking 24-hour voting or drive-through voting and so on, is seen as most likely to hurt young voters, people of color, poor people. It goes back to that issue of Republicans really fearing their power slipping away. So activists would argue this is how they're going to stop that, not by appealing to the mainstream and trying to get more votes, but actually stopping Democrats from voting.
So what you're saying then is that Republicans in Texas are trying to push through some pretty hardline policies as the demographics in the state shift, and they're working to restrict the number of people who are actually able to vote. This feels like minority rule in a sense.
Yes, you could certainly argue Republicans, especially in the era of Donald Trump, but probably before as well, have pursued minority rule, one might say white minority rule in America. Liberal activists, Democratic critics would certainly make that point. I mean, they would argue that, frankly, Republicans in Texas are at the government level there, not only out of step with your average Texan voter, they're even out of step with your average Texan Republican. It's the party leadership now that's embraced Trumpism and becoming so extreme, so radicalized, shifting so much to the far right.
So if some Republican voters are against supporting these policies, what is driving Greg Abbott to pursue them?
Greg Abbott's up for re-election for governor next year. And I think what drives a lot of it is not so much his fears of who he might be challenged by from the Democratic side, but actually his Republican opponents on his own side in Texas. Some of them are very, very extreme pro-Trump characters. And so he needs to blunt that challenge and head that off by demonstrating his own pro-Trump right-wing credentials.
I mean, it's quite extraordinary. And this issue of voting rights and the assault on them, how has that been received in Texas?
Texas has become arguably the key battleground for voting rights in America. And Democrats had a choice to, as they do on so many other issues in Texas, fight and lose, or do something different. And they decided to take radical action. And so first, they just quietly left the legislative building in the state capitol so that there was not a quorum for a vote to be held on these voter restriction measures. And then when Greg Abbott forced it back onto the agenda and ordered these politicians to return, Texas Democrats went one further and actually left the state. They sent out a message, okay, grab a bag, a toothbrush and so on, and got on airplanes and secretly flew out of Texas to Washington, D.C.
Tonight, Texas Democrats on the run.
Where are you?
I'm at the airport.
Jasmine Crockett is one of nearly 60 lawmakers who fled the Lone Star State for Washington, D.C., most traveling on two private jets, grinding the Texas legislature to a halt and preventing Republicans from taking action on a controversial voting rights bill. Had they stayed in state, Texas Rangers could have rounded them up and returned them to the Capitol.
We heard rumblings that they actually were planning to lock the chamber. They were going to hold us in there until those bills got passed.
The Texas bill would mandate new ID requirements for voting by mail and ban drive-through voting sites and 24-hour voting. 16 other states have enacted similar legislation.
Republicans, they, of course, howled with outrage about what they saw as a stunt.
I can and I will continue to call special session after special session after special session all the way up until election next year. And so if these people want to be hanging out wherever they're hanging out on this taxpayer-paid junket, they're going to have to be prepared to do it for well over a year. As soon as they come back in the state of Texas, they will be arrested. They will be cabined inside the Texas Capitol until they get their job done.
Okay, so you've explained that even though the Republicans didn't win the election last year, they still have a lot of power at a state level, as Texas shows. This is happening in other Republican states too, though, isn't it, David? Where else are we seeing this pattern being repeated?
Another vivid example is Florida, which I think is probably competing with Texas to become the hub of Trumpism. Trump won Florida both times, and right now, Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, is not only stealing some of Greg Abbott's thunder as a Trumpian figure.
Everyone knows my husband, Ron DeSantis, is endorsed by President Trump, but he's also an amazing dad. Ron loves playing with the kids.
Build the wall.
He reads stories.
Then Mr. Trump said, "You're fired." I love that part.
He's teaching Madison to talk.
Make America great again.
People say Ron's all Trump, but he is so much more.
But even potentially chipping away at Trump himself for the 2024 Republican nomination. But then, of course, you have other Republican states in the heartland that Trump won very comfortably, Oklahoma and Kentucky and Montana and Tennessee and Louisiana, Alabama, and so on. Some imposing very punitive measures, again, focusing a lot on these culture war issues, going a lot for abortion and gun rights, challenging environmental regulations. It does create a picture of two Americas, one red, one blue, ever more polarized, not speaking to each other. Joe Biden might be the president of the United States, but there are great swathes of the country that sometimes feel not exactly under his control, or at least somewhat resistant to him.
What do these bills mean for people living in these states? Are they already having an impact?
I think in some ways, yes. And obviously when a bill, for example, restricting transgender rights is passed, that's going to send a chilling message to transgender people who live in those states. And it's going to give a green light potentially to bullies and those who would persecute and those who would discriminate. Similar messages are being sent around abortion, for example.
A high school commencement speech that is making some serious waves. During her valedictorian address, 18-year-old Paxton Smith says she initially had one speech prepared for her fellow graduates of Lake Highlands High School in Dallas, Texas, but then she had a change of heart.
I have dreams and hopes and ambitions. Every girl graduating today does. And we have spent our entire lives working towards our future. And without our input and without our consent, our control over that future has been stripped away from us.
But I think when we talk about what powers do governors have, that was really illustrated perhaps as never before during the pandemic. Whether it was Trump or Biden who was president, governors wielded a tremendous amount of power determining when bars and restaurants and businesses should lock down, when mask mandates should be imposed. But you're seeing it play out very vividly now as the Delta variant spreads and there's a growing gap between Democratic voting and Republican voting counties and states. For example, there was a recent poll conducted by the Washington Post and ABC News. It showed 93% of Democrats say they'd received a vaccine or planned to, while just 49% of Republicans said the same thing. And indeed, perhaps no surprise, the worst coronavirus outbreaks are in counties and states that voted for Donald Trump, where, frankly, vaccine conspiracy theories are spreading like wildfire. They're on the internet, they're in right-wing media. And so America's great political divide is now literally costing lives, and that's a great tragedy.
Yeah, and it's fascinating that the coronavirus has played into that. But is there a limit, ultimately, David, on what states can do? Is the Supreme Court not able to rein in politicians and the decisions that they make?
One perpetual issue to watch here, of course, is always reproductive rights, where some of the Republican states, like Louisiana in particular, are almost seeking a court challenge. They want to do something extreme. They hope it will actually go to the Supreme Court. They hope to overturn the landmark Roe versus Wade ruling as national policy. And in that way, what happens at state level can actually go national and affect everybody. And we saw that and the inverse in a more positive way with same-sex marriage, of course, in 2015, where that started on a state level, but then became the way things are done across the entire country. If and when reproductive rights does reach the Supreme Court, there are many fears that perhaps Roe versus Wade could be overturned, that abortion limits might be restricted because right now conservatives hold a 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court. Remember, Donald Trump, during his 4-year presidency, was able to appoint 3 Supreme Court justices, all to the right. And that worries many liberals and is certainly they would argue, a classic case of America's minority rule. You could find many opinion polls and surveys that would suggest the politics and ideology of the Supreme Court is out of step with where the majority of the American population is, certainly on reproductive rights and many other issues.
Okay, so those are the dynamics on a state level. How is this all feeding back into the Republican Party in Washington?
You now have very Trumpian right-wing figures such as Matt Gaetz, a congressman from Florida, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, a congresswoman from Georgia, sucking up a lot of oxygen, dominating a lot of headlines, and not being censored by the Republican Party. Meanwhile, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who ideologically is very conservative, she voted for Trump's impeachment. She wanted a full investigation into the January the 6th insurrection, and she was ousted from Republican Party leadership. And that really sent a very strong message that Trump and all he stands for is still embraced by the party, not only at the state level, but at the national level. And it's interesting, in the Senate, there is at least an appearance of greater moderation and some willingness to work with Joe Biden, for example, on an infrastructure package. And Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, is certainly no friend of Donald Trump. And yet, when it comes to the crunch, those senators still deployed a procedural rule known as the filibuster to block a bipartisan commission to investigate the insurrection. And they're still hell-bent on imposing restrictions on voting rights, whether or not they publicly embrace Trump's big lie about a stolen election. And so you still basically in America have one of the two great major parties radicalizing, becoming ever more extreme, really, many would say, moving to the far right.
And so that's what the Republicans say through their votes and also what they say publicly. But when you speak to them in DC, what did they say to you privately about what's happening and what they're feeling about it?
There are certainly some Republicans who privately despise Donald Trump and wish he was gone and understand the chaos, but they're often just cowed into silence because he is so dominant and because to criticize Trump means you will be exorcised and you may lose your local primary election and indeed even face bullying and harassment at airports and other places.
Well, the party's divided on this. Maybe 20, 30, 40% of Republicans are with Trump out of conviction, and that's just where they want to be. And then you have the rest of the party that's afraid because they know that Trump has the energy, he has the grassroots support, and he's willing to aim at them and try to destroy them and may succeed.
Look at what's happening in Texas. The beast is growing. The beast is not satisfied with just that premise. The beast wants more. And I, to this point, don't know where the beast is going because it's unheard of that an Abbott would be challenged from the right. It's unheard of.
And then there are other Republicans who truly embrace Trumpism will tell you this is the future of the party. And so much of that, I think, is driven by hatred of the other side. It's all about what they call owning the libs, as in whatever will goad liberals and wind them up is something to be celebrated. And all of this is constantly reinforced by the right-wing media ecosystem.
With friends like this, considering what we're up against, no wonder we're on the verge of American Marxism.
There's no question about it. You know, we the people are going to have to take action ourselves. We cannot rely on the Liz Cheneys, the Romneys, or the others of the world. They're like out of the 1950s Republican Party. They don't understand what's swirling around our country today. Joe Biden and his party are playing for keeps.
Fox News, the One American News Network, countless websites feed a conspiratorial narrative that says liberals and Democrats control not only Washington, but also Hollywood and Silicon Valley and Wall Street, all the great centers of power in America. And Trump is our best chance of fighting back.
Gosh, how worrying. And you say that many of the Republicans you speak to say they want to rile the libs. How is Joe Biden responding to all of this? What has been his approach so far?
Joe Biden's response has been to lower the political temperature and not rise to the bait. And I think many would argue that's absolutely the right strategy. Biden, I think, is really trying to style himself as the anti-Trump in that sense. Some argue even to be quite willfully boring. You know, his tweets are very milquetoast, probably not even written by him. He doesn't give many press conferences. His speeches are a return to the old norms of Washington. One author and journalist at the New York Times styled it as speak softly, but pass a big agenda, as opposed to speak softly and carry a big stick. It's the idea of really the opposite of the smash mouth, in your face, Trump constant drama.
So hear me clearly. There's an unfolding assault taking place in America today, an attempt to suppress and subvert the right to vote and fair and free elections.
An exception to this rule was a couple of weeks ago when Joe Biden gave what was billed as a major speech about voting rights. He went to Philadelphia, the birthplace of American democracy, and he did somewhat take the gloves off and go after Donald Trump and Republicans.
The big lie is just that, a big lie.
At one point, he demanded of them, have you no shame?
No shame.
Even then, he did not mention Donald Trump by name. But that was Biden, I think, arguably somewhat belatedly responding to pressure to be a bit more outspoken and forthright and aggressive, at least on the voting rights issue. But I think he remains determined not to be drawn into a constant war of words with Donald Trump. There is nothing Trump would love more than that kind of attention.
Coming up, could Trump make a comeback in 2024? David, the midterm elections are just around the corner, really, in November 2022. How do you think things might unfold politically over the next 18 months?
Next year's midterm elections are going to be nasty. I think you'll see a lot of mini Trumps trying to whip up anger. And Biden will certainly face a challenge to respond to that. He's obviously not up for re-election himself, but he'll be campaigning on behalf of Democrats. And I think their main message will be to try and show the difference they're making to people's lives, how Democrats spent big on coronavirus relief to turn the economy around. They literally sent money to parents of children with a new child tax credit. You'll definitely see some contrasting styles there.
Going back to Donald Trump, is the influence he has over the Republican Party one that is playing out in his legacy, or does he himself actually still have a lot of influence, still play a role in the direction that the party is going in?
Well, Trump himself still plays a role in the direction of the party. He's still regularly meeting the top party officials. He's pumping out emailed press statements that maybe don't make much impact nationally, but I guess Republicans are reading them. He's giving speeches at the Conservative Political Action Conference and other events. And perhaps most importantly, he's still a huge fundraiser. He remains the unofficial leader of that party. What he says probably counts more than any other figure. And he may well run for president again in 2024.
Oh, wow. So you really think he's going to run again?
If I had to bet, I would say probably yes, just judging by his continued level of engagement. I can just imagine he would love the attention and the drama. I think, you know, Trump, as a businessman, wrote a book called The Art of the Deal, but he wrote another one called The Art of the Comeback. And what could be more theatrical, more dramatic than launching himself saying this is the greatest political comeback in history, which I'm sure how he would describe it. And so in that sense, America's nightmare continues. It is the horror movie where you think the villain has been defeated, but there's still an added twist.
From what you've said, David, it's very clear that the Republicans have chosen to take a certain path, and that means that they are the party of Donald Trump. How well do you think they'll do at the midterms next year, and how much of a problem are they going to be for Joe Biden?
Despite everything, despite the lies, despite the deaths from coronavirus, as things stand, most people expect Republicans to win back the House of Representatives next year, partly because the party that does not have the White House usually does very well in the midterms. You know, that's where the energy is. And so whatever problems Joe Biden has now, they're going to be magnified many times if he's got Congress dead against him.
David, thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you very much.
That was Rachel Humphries talking to reporter David Smith, The Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Dominic Fitzgerald. The executive producers of Today in Focus are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. Additional production by Alison Chan. Okay, I'll be back tomorrow with another episode of Full Story.